everyday witches emerge from the shadows of secrecy. Broom closets are flinging open and witches are taking flight. Whether you are hiding in your cozy closet or flying with pride, stay for a spell as Witch Casting with Theodora Pendragon and her guests share magical moments, stir the cauldron, and debunk misinformation and misconceptions about paganism, witches, and our wonderful world of magic.
Hello, this is Theodora Pendragon with a special guest today. Their name is Harris Eddie Hill. Welcome, Harris.
Hey, thank you so much for having me on today. It's a real pleasure.
You are an intuitive healer.
Yeah, yeah. So I have been helping people for a long time. But, you know, my sort of family culture and also my sort of the schools that I grew up going to were very pro-science. And I'm also very pro-science. But it took a lot of wrestling to realize that what I was doing was probably more in the realm of a healer, you know, like in other cultures or other times, there would have been a local healer who was, you know, what I'm doing is not scientific, and it's more intuitive, it's more emotional, it's spiritual. It took me a while to embrace the term of healer, having come from such a patriarchal and logical, quote unquote, background. But I think healer makes sense.
Tell us about your healing.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess it all, on the one hand, and I'm sure a lot of maybe even you, Theodora, but a lot of people listening will relate to, but I was always the one who my friends, my family would come and talk to. I didn't invite it. They just poured their hearts out. And when you're young and inexperienced and nobody's taught you about emotionally healthy relationships or boundaries, consent, how to regulate your own emotions, that can be like a really tough thing when you don't have that skill. Nobody's trained you, nobody's taught you. I then ended up going through my own healings. My main one, and I won't go into detail just for the sake of people listening, in case they're not okay to hear it, but I suffered some childhood sexual abuse, and that happened once when I was still like primary school age, and then it happened again in my teens with a partner, and then again in my 20s with a guy that I was on a date with. It was such severe PTSD that I could be, you know, I might read a newspaper headline on my phone and just completely lose it and just be gone and be so dysregulated and upset and shaking and right back in that moment. And, you know, I'd gone to sort of doctors and counselors and therapists for years and said, I've got this really crippling PTSD. It's really terrible. What can we do about it? And they were like, well, I don't really know what you mean. And I was like, well, surely the brain is like capable of being damaged. So surely it's just capable of being healed. And they were like, I don't know what you're talking about. So I just so happened in my later 20s to come across a regular therapist that I knew, but unbeknownst to me, she had done this extra training in other stuff. And again, this was dipping into the sort of side of, I guess you might call it, some people might refer to that kind of thing as energy healing. It's sort of in that realm. It's an emotional experience rather than a logical one. And logical me and the part of me that was very brainwashed was like, well, this sounds a bit mental. It sounds a bit weird. But I was like, at that point, I had nothing to lose. I was like, well, I'll go for it. I'll give it a go and just see what happens. We did it. Two sessions, 2 hours of processing this PTSD. And it's never come back since. I've not been triggered once. I've not been, you know, I've been totally okay to handle it. And since then, it's been revealed that two people I know are predators. And obviously, I'm responding to that as a normal, moral adult, but I'm not responding to it as a trauma victim anymore. So it was really life-changing. So after that, I retrained, and then I had some wobbles of my own again, and I went back to that therapist and said, there's something still not right. So in that gap, she had done further training, a master's in traumatology. She did an assessment, took me through the beginning. She said, you've got complex PTSD as a result of your upbringing. And it really, I mean, it made sense. It made me feel like I wasn't losing my mind, and that the way I was behaving, it wasn't my fault. Like it was a trauma response. And at the same time, that was quite difficult to swallow, you know, because, you know, had you asked me before, what's your family life like? I would have said, it's a mixture. You know, there's some good bits and some tough bits, and, you know, there's some dysfunction, but also we have a lot of fun. So to come to terms with that was really, really tough. However, coming out of all of that stuff, it really made me realize that there's so much to healing that has got nothing to do with a therapist or a counselor or a psychiatrist or whatever. Not to say that those jobs aren't important, because they absolutely are, but it's not the only part of it. Once I really started to lean into this and started to coach, and then I ended up going to work for the NHS, the National Health System in the UK service, sorry, and ended up coaching people from loads of different backgrounds. Again, I saw this real gap, like most of the things that people were dealing with in the doctor's office where I worked, whether they came to talk about diabetes or managing their fibromyalgia or a little bit of depression and anxiety, it all, like 98% of it, I would say, came down to childhood trauma. And the work I started to do with those people, the coaching and then the visualizations that I was taking them into, was all intuitively led. So whilst I had retrained as a coach, so much of the work that I've ended up doing with people is totally intuitive. And as people are sharing with me, you know, what they've struggled with and what they've been through, I have a real deep sense, firstly, of how that feels in their body. I never say that, because I only use it as a guide for what we're doing. But if, for instance, we're talking about, you know, I have a one patient who had a big mother wound. She had a, you know, her mother was very verbally abusive to her and very unkind. And I said to her, where do you feel that in your body? And it felt like a big lump from about the solar plexus right up the neck, but sort of up the front, like this big, heavy, solid mass. And when I asked her to describe it to me, she explained the exact same thing that I could feel when I asked her the question. So I guess all of this intuitive healing stuff is happening. But it's just taken me longer to accept that I am a bit woo-woo, and it is a bit weird, and it doesn't fit into the traditional world of anything medical or scientific.
You mentioned that when you were a child, people were drawn to you. So you were an empath as a child, and you became intuitive over the years.
I think I was always intuitive, even when I was really small. If there was some tension, like between a married couple, even when I was tiny, I would notice that. I would feel that. Even if it had nothing to do with me, I could often sense, even if someone was smiling at me, I knew if it was fake. So, you know, and I think a lot of people relate to that.
Do you think that you chose to be intuitive in that intuition developed more, or did this all just happen very organically?
I think it was totally organic. And actually, for a lot of my life, I resisted it. And this is the thing, is that, you know, long before there were any kind of really traumatic stuff that happened or anything else, it was there. And as I became older and aware of what people around me thought about that kind of thing, I knew that it was considered weird and that I would be criticized if I shared it or was open about it. So I didn't. And ignoring and suppressing that intuition got me into trouble many times with the wrong people, people who made me feel unsafe. But the second that I heard or felt that intuition, I ignored it. And it got me into trouble many times. And
would you say that your ego got in the way when you didn't listen to your intuition?
No, I don't think it was ego. I think it was more just that I was really taught. I was very kind of brainwashed. I was like, this is what we do. This is how we behave. We don't listen to that. It's nonsense. You know, I just need to use my brain and just be logical about things. And it definitely wasn't ego. It was, and I guess maybe fear of criticism. So maybe there was a bit of ego in the fact that there was fear, but mostly it was just not in my culture or, you know, the culture that I grew up in that you would, that was even a thing. And if someone claimed it was a thing, they would be ridiculed.
But now you listen to your intuition.
Oh yeah. It's there all day, every day.
As an empath, do you think that most empaths are inherently traumatized in some way?
No, and I've met some who aren't. I think that there's something that happens, and being in the world of trauma, being an empath is constantly conflated with codependency. And this is something that is not, I feel, not talked about enough, because to me, being an empath is purely like a spiritual skill, a gift, or maybe even just the ability to register what's going on more than just the verbal or the obvious. And I don't think that, you know, animals do the same thing, don't they? If you've got a dog and you're feeling a bit down, they can literally smell it on you. So I don't think it's magic. I just think that it's a skill that some people are just born with. Whereas codependency is, so I didn't know the difference. When I started to heal, I also wondered if trauma and empathy went together. I wonder if I'm only this sensitive out of survival. And I wonder if when I heal, not that we're ever done completely healing, but you know, the majority of it has been dealt with, at least as far as I can tell. Once I'm really healed and I feel much better, I wonder if my empathy will kind of decrease out of necessity because I don't need it so much anymore. And actually the opposite became true. It became like, because my body was calmer, I was able to listen a lot more and to, you know, my anxiety wasn't getting in the way anymore. And I was not, you know, either self-sabotaging or self-sacrificing or giving too much. You know, overall, my existence was much calmer. I felt much more at peace and much more able to kind of give myself pause to say no, you know, to kind of start living for myself rather than other people. And codependency is on a scale between, so if you're into self-development books, I don't know if you like that sort of thing, Theodora, but there's a book called The Human Magnet Syndrome. And this, he's a psychiatrist or psychologist. Anyway, he came up with this scale to understand it and to visualize this scale between codependency and narcissism or any other condition that makes you completely self-orientated. And the people at the other end of the scale are codependents. Codependent, the word gets thrown around all the time, but in terms of psychology, it doesn't mean like that you rely on other people, because obviously that can be done in a very healthy way and it's necessary. As humans, we're social creatures and that's okay. But the codependent end is the end where we have survived our environment by being completely focused on other people. So it's an imbalance. So we might have been in an environment where we've got like a turbulent adult or a very sick adult or you know, an adult who's not able to kind of hold that role of sort of guide and protector and nurturer. And that's been disrupted. And therefore, in order to survive our environment, we have to kind of anticipate their needs, not put a foot out of line in case we anger them or you know, face potential rejection, all of these different things. So it makes us completely wired to look at other people. And the only way that we as codependents can feel safe or valued or worthy is if other people are giving that to us.
And with codependency, it's that feeling that this person will not do well unless I take care of them, unless I do something for them. And anticipating them as far as, like, for example, in addictions, a codependent person will anticipate, well, what if they relapse? I must behave this way or that way. So
yeah,
my friend, my mother, my child, my lover does not relapse. That's codependency.
Mm-hmm. Yes, because you're, because of the environment that you've survived, you've been taught that you have this power, like unconsciously, but you've been taught that I have the power to influence how other people feel or what they do or how they behave. And you take that belief into your life where it's like, you know, I have a lot of power of influence here. If I, like you say, if I behave this way, then hopefully it won't trigger that person into a relapse. Or, you know, if I behave this way, and this is often where, especially women, but potentially anybody, we get into relationships with people and we're convinced that if we try hard enough, we can get them to A, love us, and B, understand us.
You know, that's a big responsibility to feel that you're responsible for another adult. It can be a burden.
Yeah, and massively dysfunctional. I went through this really interesting experience where after I'd done a lot of my healing, I dated someone who I didn't know at the time until it was too late that they were codependent. And at that time I wasn't. And in fact, I was probably going through a little bit of a counter-dependent phase, which is really common when you're recovering from codependency, that you go through this phase of like, I don't need anyone. Like I don't, you know, you have a little bit of a break or like an aversion to it. And I dated this codependent person and I was like, wow, this is suffocating. And I could see that even though I was trying to relate in a healthy way, I was trying to communicate, listen, you know, I understand how you feel, totally get it, I've been there, but this kind of dynamic or this behavior is not working for me. It's making me, you know, I do feel a bit like suffocated, or I don't feel that you're listening to my boundaries here, or, you know, you're asking for a lot from me and we're just getting to know each other, you know. And to them, I probably did look like very avoidant, even though I was very present and tried to be very present. It was really interesting and very humbling to be on the other side of that, of dating somebody who's codependent, to see how someone with such a deep need that they're not meeting in any way on their own can really also kill a relationship with a healthy person.
But at that time, you had done a lot of work on yourself, so you did not need anybody to take care of you.
Yeah.
That's why it was suffocating.
Well, also, they just wanted like so much, you know, I might leave their house at 10 in the morning, having spent the whole night at their place. And, you know, we'd gone on a date the night before, we'd had dinner and a movie, and we spent all of this wonderful time together. We'd had a long breakfast in the morning. And then within about 6 or 7 hours of me leaving their house, I would get voicemails of them crying, "You don't like me, you don't like me. Like, I think I feel stronger than you do." And I was like, I'm at work and I left your house like 6 or 7 hours ago. We've spent all this time together. And they were like, "No, you're lying and you don't really feel anything." So there was that real insecure attachment there that was, it really ruined things a lot.
Oh, that's too bad.
Yeah. So I had so much empathy for them. Like, and totally recognize that I used to be exactly the same, maybe not quite to the same degree, but definitely the same feelings, definitely. But because of their distress, they were railroading my boundaries repeatedly when I was like, listen, if I've just seen you some hours ago, like you being upset with me for not giving you enough, it's like, you know, it's not a very nice thing to be on the receiving end of. I think you need to go away and talk it through with somebody else. And come back when you're feeling a bit more regulated. And they just didn't. It was just every time they felt a distance or that I wasn't giving enough, it became my problem immediately.
But there is somebody out there for that person?
Yeah.
They just need to find them.
Yeah, 100%. 100%.
You've reclaimed your spirituality. What does that mean to you?
It's really interesting because I grew up going to a church in the Church of England. My dad still goes. And I was at a wedding at the weekend that was also held in another Church of England place. And I knew all the words by heart. Like, you know, there was all of these wedding guests and none of them knew the prayers and the responses, but I knew them all off by heart. So it was literally the vicar who was leading the wedding ceremony, the vicar at the back doing all of the sound engineering, and me saying all the words at the right time, and everyone else is like silent. And it's really odd because in those moments I do feel deep belonging, and at the same time I really felt for a long time, I was like, this place is just not for me, or the way that they do things is not for me. Granted, Church of England is pretty liberal in terms of different types of Christianity throughout the world, you know, but it's still not quite there yet. And also I feel having a background in intersectional rights and learning about things like white supremacy, you know, all the theory behind all of that stuff, that so much of what we have now in terms of the religion that I was brought up in, at least, is so watered down. It's so diluted. We've lost so much of the meaning, the mysticism, everything, to the point that it feels now like something that was probably once very mystical and far more pagan than it is now has been watered down and diluted to the point that it's now palatable for people who don't believe in very much, or whose belief is prescribed. And for a long time, once I left home at 19 and I went to go and live in the Midlands, which is in the middle of England. I know to Americans that probably sounds like somewhere where hobbits live. but I went up there and I tried out some different churches. I tried out an evangelical church. I didn't know I was non-binary then. And I tried out a Pentecostal church. And in both of those, I felt very almost straitjacketed. You know, I have a lot of love for people, and I feel like that's one thing that I do agree on in terms of the religion and me. We definitely agree on loving other people. But there are other things, I swear a lot. I have to be very conscious about the language that I use and not being too cheeky or rude. You know, I think the fact that I had short hair even then when I was there was a bit like people would sort of look at you like, not sure about that. Even if they didn't say anything, it was written all over their face. So for a long time after that, I left all of the churches after I'd ignored my intuition one time and got involved with this guy who had a terrible heroin addiction. There was a whole drama there, and bless him, he struggled really badly with that. And once he was part of that religious, very religious, kind of very strict way of living, despite his rampant drug addiction. And after that, I just was exhausted from the whole thing. And I spent probably 4 or so years just being like, I can't stomach anything to do with this. It feels too traumatic. I feel like I'm being judged again. I feel like I'm being told what to think and believe and feel. And, you know, it felt like there was a part of me that really needed all of that. But I was like, it's not here, babe. Like, you can't keep looking in the wrong place. You've got to find this within you, and then you'll know what you're doing. And I then learned about empaths, and then I started listening to audiobooks by Judith Orloff, who, as far as I'm concerned, is the OG empath. And I then got into self-development, and I started to come across all of these kind of core, like, mystical beliefs and practices that date back, you know, thousands of years, that seem to be at the core of most spiritual beliefs. And I was like, this to me feels true. And this is what resonates. And actually that I don't need a middleman. I don't need anyone yelling at me from a pulpit to tell me whether I'm deserving or not. Like, I have this direction. I don't need anyone in the middle to kind of ration this stuff out to me. I can have it right now in this moment. I don't need to go into a building and I don't need to be told how to experience this. And it's just, I have this already. It's within me and I'm worthy already. And I am, and I think this is another thing, and I don't know about you, Theodora, but I feel that in religion, there's this idea that we are separate from the universe or whatever it is that you believe. Whereas I feel very strongly that we are aspects of that power, whatever you call it, experiencing itself, and that there is no separation, and that other human beings, we're all part of the same force and the same love and everything else. So that, you know, when I look at other people, even if I don't like them, or even if they hold values that I think are harmful and unkind and unloving, I still recognize that we're still part of the same thing. I find that far more profound and far more powerful and a way to govern my life than a church ever gave me.
It was then you decided to cut out the middleman.
Yeah.
What do you think about masculine and feminine energies as a non-binary person?
Yeah, it's interesting. I personally feel that I have a very strong sense of what those things are, but I recognize that in my work, it's not necessarily helpful to the people that I look after. Like, so many of my clients are LGBTQ+ or neurodivergent like me, or empaths. And, you know, people have all got their own relationships to that. And I also recognize that a lot of discussion around feminine and masculine stuff enforces this idea that we kind of have to be one or the other, mostly. You know, I see so much in the coaching world, particularly, where you've got these very enigmatic men talking about, even if they think they're being positive, but they're talking about how, you know, if we as men are not able to be masculine enough, then the women that we want to date will not be kind of protected enough to feel that they can be in their feminine. And I'm like, that's such a... I get that where they're coming from, it seems so sincere, some of these guys. Like, they really seem like they mean it and they want to do a good job at being men. But I'm like, I don't think that anyone is asking for that. I'm sure it happens sometimes in the corners of cultures and the internet. But generally speaking, I've never heard a woman that I know or have ever met say, he was really lovely, but he wasn't masculine enough. I have never heard that. And similarly, I have never heard a man say of a woman, she wasn't feminine enough. Like, generally, if men like someone, in my experience, you know, someone of any gender, they don't give a shit. they're like, I get on with this person, you know, I feel like I want to take their clothes off. Like, that's kind of enough for me. So, you know, I think masculine and feminine energy and the discussion around that is helpful in terms of, like, to notice what we're doing, maybe, or the space that we're in, or the maybe even the traits of ours that we're not utilizing that we actually have. Beyond that, I don't get why people are so prescriptive about it, because it seems obvious to me that we all have access to both, and that we're souls before anything else, and we can be anything. Like, surely that's like the whole point of why we came on it, like, to Earth, to experience the fullness of life, not just half of it.
But that man you were referring to, who wants to be masculine enough to protect the woman in his life, or to find a woman he can protect, he will find that if that's what he is looking for and that's what he needs. But he's talking from the perspective of everybody must feel this way, but we don't.
I have a question, though, because I feel like if you're trying very hard to be something, you're not that.
I agree.
If you're like, you know, we've got to up the game, guys. We've got to be more masculine. I'm like, no. Well, you don't have to be anything. Actually, to be yourself would be far better, and then you'd be far more likely to find someone who was genuinely compatible with you and that, and a relationship that's therefore more likely to be sustainable, right?
Right.
I have not yet a straight woman who's seen a guy like, you know, like pick up a kitten or a baby and hasn't gone, oh my God, I want to marry him immediately, you know. Generally, when men have a soft moment, all the women I've ever met are like, oh, that was like, I ovulated at that moment. Like, I want, you know, like, oh, I want a guy like that. I want a guy like that. I've never heard of, you know, men having soft moments as being anything other than like really desirable.
That's a very good point.
So, yeah. I have met people who are naturally very masculine and feminine, but they're not trying. That's totally natural. That is absolutely what they're like. And those particular characters, I never really ever hear them criticize anybody else for not being feminine or masculine enough either.
You mentioned earlier that you have clients. What kind of services do you provide them? And do you do this in person or also virtually?
So at the moment, I only really work with people online, and I founded earlier this year the Center for Childhood Trauma Healing. And I mostly, at the moment, I'm working with people one-on-one to help them to really heal from their childhood trauma. During that time, I would never force homework on anyone, and homework is such a triggering word for so many people. But most clients will want to have something to kind of support the work that we're doing. So, you know, I've got a lot of book recommendations and, you know, some free courses that I know about and other bits and pieces. And basically, all the time I've done this work with people to help them heal their childhood trauma, I can guarantee every time so far, they turn up to the 12th session. So we worked together for 3 months. They turn up to the 12th session with a big smile on their face and they're like, I'm ready, I'm done. And so we, you know, it only takes about that long. It's really magical and it's really lovely. And I think it is the highlight of my job, I think, when somebody feels so confident and happy. And, you know, we might not have tackled every single issue that they've ever had, but we've tackled enough that they're like, I can keep going with this and I know what to do now. And they're out of the kind of endless years worth of therapy looping, where they think that they're just not therapying hard enough. This healing is not the same as therapy, because in my experience, therapy is about becoming more self-aware, more self-compassionate, possibly looking at things a different way, becoming analytical and kind of more objective about things maybe. And, you know, you might learn some stuff along the way, but there's no actual trauma processing that happens in a traditional therapy setting. And that's where people like me come in, who, you know, we're like, you're ready to be done with it. Like I was then. I was like, when my healer, my therapist said to me, do you want to get rid of your PTSD? She was the first person who told me it was possible. And I nearly bit her hand off. I was like, can we do it right now? She's like, no, we have to do some other work first. But I think by the time you're ready, it can be really quick, just as quickly as the incidents that bothered you happened. They can be transformed and healed just as quickly. So that's the one-to-one work. And then I'm just about to, on October the 10th, I believe, I'm running a webinar all about trauma. And off the back of that, I will be offering some folks the opportunity to do at least half of the trauma work in a group setting. So it's cheaper. And they also get the advantage of having a community to heal with as well, which I know that I didn't have when I went through this. So
if somebody wants to attend your webinar, how can they find you?
So it's on my website, muxharrishill.com. That's muxharrishill.com. And it's literally a pink banner at the very top that just says register for my webinar. So you can just go from there.
Okay. I'll add your website to the episode notes.
Thank you.
So hopefully you'll have many people who will attend your webinar on trauma.
Thank you.
Whatever that trauma is, because everybody perceives trauma differently.
Yeah, 100%. It's so nuanced. The number of things that I've processed with people and it's just so, so nuanced. It might be a type of music, or it really could be anything.
If you were to give the audience one piece of advice today, what would that be?
I think when it comes to healing and childhood trauma or any type of trauma, I think taking the power back, however that looks to you, in terms of taking charge of your healing is so important, because I feel that we very much live in a culture where we talk about mental health and healing, and the only people we generally tend to think of are therapists, psychologists and that type of person. And they definitely deserve it at the seat of the table. I'm not doubting that for a second. But yet the monopoly is not theirs. It's yours. Like, your healing is how you're going to do it. And actually, you can go and see the most accredited person in the world. They will not know the path to your healing better than you do. I'm not suggesting that we don't have biases, especially whilst we're triggered or traumatized. What I mean is in that still quietness of real honesty, sobriety and self-reflection, your intuition, your subconscious, whatever, will know where to take you and where you need to go better than anyone else, including people like me. And the better educated you are, so, you know, audiobooks is how I found a lot of my own healing and salvation, is a really big one. And then finding people who you can process your trauma with, which is not the same as therapy. So keep looking, try things out, trust your gut. If somebody doesn't feel safe, then don't do it. Look for good testimonials and don't give up.
Never give up. Thank you, Harris, for your very informative interview. This has been wonderful.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure.
And we must follow our intuition. You know, our intuition does not fail us.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for joining us for Witchcasting with Theodora Pendragon. Have a burning question or have a topic you'd love Theodora and her guests to discuss on the show? Contact her through Instagram at Theodora Pendragon. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure to subscribe so you don't miss the next one. And help us spread the word by leaving us a rating and review and sharing it with your friends. See you next time, and may your magic always shine.